what I want to do is give a 30-minute or so presentation, and then we'll have a panel discussion, and the members, some members of the theology group will be here to help us with the panel discussion. And Dr. Julie Foltz is here, and she's from my church, and she's a physician, and she works in urgent care. And one thing we did in our church last year is we had a workshop, I guess, a Saturday workshop on finishing well as disciples in the church. And we talked about a number of things, and Julie was able to give her medical expertise and speak into that. So I've asked her to be part of this as well. So, I want to start with this. This is kind of just to set the table for the discussion. And also, the panel discussion is a time for Q&A, but also for you all to share your experiences and your wisdom in this. I'm not coming at this as an expert at all. So I want to start with sharing an experience I had a few years ago in my ministry that illustrates why I think it's important to talk about this topic. This happened a couple years ago in the context of COVID. It was starting to tail off, but it was still on our radar. And there was an elderly man in our congregation who was getting sick and weaker. The doctors could not provide a firm diagnosis of what was going on, but it was clear he was on a kind of a downward trajectory, getting weaker, stomach pains. He was admitted to the hospital, and so I went to visit him. When I visited him, he said he was feeling okay. He didn't have a firm diagnosis at that point. He was weak, but he was able to speak. He was responsive, and so I prayed with him. I anointed him with oil. I assured him of God's love and God's forgiveness. So then I went back to the hospital a couple of days after that to check in on him. And when I came in to, onto the floor, I saw doctors and nurses going in and out of his room. And I went into his room and they were working on him. Medical staff was working on him. He was bleeding. He was bleeding out. And so they were prepping him to get him into the ICU. And I was able to say a brief prayer with him before they whisk him away. It was the last time I was able to talk with him. His wife was there, and obviously she was greatly distraught. And so after he left and they transferred him to the ICU, I said to his wife, I said, after a while we prayed together, and she was processing. And I said, Sue, have you thought about what would happen if he doesn't get better? And again, this is kind of in the context of COVID. And I said, you know, if they put him on a ventilator, you know, how would you think about that? And have you thought about that? Like, what issues might come up? And I was hoping to open up a conversation about that, because I could see this is probably where this is headed. And she said, oh, no, they're just taking him away to stabilize him and get better. And so I knew that we were in for a rocky path, most likely. So he didn't get better. He did go on a ventilator. And a few days later, I gathered with his wife, his daughter, and son as they took him off the ventilator and prayed the Liturgy of Last Rites, the ministry to the dying in the Book of Common Prayer. And we commended him to the Lord, and shortly after that, he did breathe his last. So I was grateful I got to be with him and to minister to him and his family in that way. But I wish I would have done more earlier. I wish I'd have been a little more intentional in my pastoral care up front, right when he started getting sick, because he had been sick at home and was struggling with things. And I was kind of waiting to see how things would play out. And I wish I'd have been more intentional. I wish I would have. I felt like I needed to be a little bit more clear with him on the hope of the gospel as he was going through these things, and ask how he was processing things spiritually. reminding him and his wife of the hope of the gospel. And I had hoped that he and his wife had thought through what sort of treatment he would receive if there was no hope of recovery, but none of that happened. So on my end, I wasn't very intentional in my pastoral care, but also there were cultural forces at play that I think make it difficult sometimes to provide the kind of pastoral care that I'm envisioning here that needs to happen. And so what I want to do in this talk is, since I'm a preacher, I have 3 points. And even better, I've alliterated them. 3 P's. 3 P's for you. As I think about this, I try to structure this talk. The problems we face, the way the prayer book can help us, and then getting the people of the parish involved. Okay? So I want to talk first about the cultural forces, the problems that make it difficult to minister to the dying and the grieving and the sick. And then I look forward to the panel discussion, a time of Q&A, and sharing our own experiences and helping one another in this. So the problems. One of the cultural realities we face is what Alan Verhey, in his book on the Christian Art of Dying, calls the medicalization of death. And some of you are nodding along, you're familiar with that term. The medicalization of death. Prior to World War II, and just after World War II, most people died at home. In 1945, 40% of people died in the hospital. In 1990, this is Verhey here, it was 90% of people dying in the hospital. So we have this cultural transition here. Now, I think hospice has come in to help with this. And so I give thanks and praise for the hospice movement because it's not all just medicalized now, but it still is a reality. You know, when Christians died at home in the early 1900s and before, family, friends, loved ones, clergy were there to gather with them and pray and to be encouraged by the dying and to encourage the dying. It was not uncommon for dying Christians to bear witness to their faith, to encourage onlookers with last words, and even sometimes to describe visions of Christ and angels. For example, Jonathan Edwards died just after becoming president of Princeton University, and the trustees were gathered in the bedroom as he was dying. They were over, I guess, in the corner. They were talking about their anxieties and their worries now that the president, who had just become president, was dying. Edwards' last words were, I think, a mixture of encouragement and rebuke. His very last words, "Trust in God and you need not fear." Those were his last words. But those words encouraged the people who were present. But with the medicalization of death, as Verhey puts it, there's no longer a role for the dying person. The dying person is a sick person. And he says it like this: no one is dying. Everyone's just sick. And they're looking for medicine to solve the problem. The role of the dying person is diminished. Related to the medicalization of death is the denial of death. And I don't think we have to say too much about this. We're all aware of these things. The euphemisms meant to blush the harsh reality of death. Euphemisms like passing away, passing on. More disconcerting is the way that Americans attempt to deny death even after somebody has died. So, you know, we instead of having funerals, we have celebrations of life. And this was interesting. One of the most popular memorial cards provided by funeral homes in North America quotes a poem that contains this, I say in my manuscript here, this drivel. This is one of the most popular poems given out in America and in Canada. It goes like this: "Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not there. I do not sleep. I am 1,000 winds that blow. I am the diamond glints on snow. So this kind of new agey idea of like my life force has gone into nature. And that's the hope, you know, that's where I'm at now. Do not stand at my grave and cry, I am not there, I did not die. That's how the poem ends. Again, not wanting to deal with the reality of death. So we have the medicalization of death, we have the denial of death. And the final cultural trend I want to talk about that we're up against is the attempt to control death. And this comes from a Canadian Lutheran pastor. And you know what's going on in Canada with these medical-assisted suicide laws. It's called MAID, Medical Aid in Dying. And so he talks about this in one of his books, and he puts it like this. When people can no longer deny death, we believe we can control it and even thereby come to worship it. He puts it like this. Death is now the great deliverer from suffering. And MAID doctors are the high priest who can usher the faithful into its fearful presence. And I don't know if you've been paying attention to what's going on in Canada and how these medical-assisted, medical aid in dying laws are expanding. This year, I've read that they're going to include mental illness as a category for those who are eligible to partake in this. Yeah, so it started with just physical suffering, and now they've expanded it to mental suffering as well. So in the light of these problems, these cultural realities, the medicalization of death, the denial of death, the attempt to control death, as Christians, we need to teach and practice the Christian way of dying and grieving. We need to look at our own heritage and our traditions to help us recover a way of navigating these mysteries that frame it all in the gospel of Jesus Christ and help our people and help ourselves understand that the hope of the gospel as we go through these things. What is the Christian way of dying and grieving? Here I want to credit Dr. Julie Canlis and the work that she's done and the notes that she gave me. And she reminded me of this tradition, this medieval tradition, the Ars Moriendi, the art of dying. This was a medieval tradition that developed in the during the time of the Black Plagues, when priests were not available. So many people were dying, and the priests themselves were dying. And so you couldn't always have a priest there. And so this literature developed. It actually is like, kind of like picture books. They used woodcut illustrations, and they had text around the pictures to kind of prepare people for their own death and the temptations and the struggles for the dying person, but also to prepare people who were attending to the death. And so, again, this was something that developed during the Black Plague. The goal was to help people prepare spiritually for death, and to help those who were loved ones and those who were there present while Christians were dying. And Julie Canlis says this. She talks about the anthropology that was at work in this art of dying tradition, this art of dying literature. And she compares it to modern anthropology. And she says the art of dying tradition, as you read the literature, you read these books that came out of this tradition, sees the human being as a beloved pilgrim of God whose dignity is not a function of their control, their independence, nor degraded by suffering. Okay? But rather, their dignity is that they're made in the image of God. It's a dignity that they receive from God, their creator. And that is a thread through this literature that Julie Canlis lifted up. And she says that's in contrast to a modern anthropology, which says to be human is to be autonomous, to be in control. And if your humanity is diminished if you're not in control or autonomous. Rather than the biblical anthropology, to be human is to be a creature of God, and all human beings therefore have inherent dignity and worth, and for the Christian to be on a pilgrimage back to God. when we die. So this art of dying tradition is part of our heritage, and that anthropology is there in our prayer book. This idea of being on a pilgrim journey back to God, and that God is with us throughout this journey in our sickness, in our grief, and in our dying. And so what I want to do now is look at how this the prayer book tradition can help us recover this anthropology and to embody it and ritualize it in the ways that we minister to people, okay? So first we have in the prayer book, rites of healing. This is ministry to the sick. This is communion to the sick. And I have here in mind, especially those who are of course it applies to anyone who's sick in the parish, but as I'm thinking about ministry to those who are sick and dying and suffering and those around them who are grieving this, I'm thinking here in the context of those who are chronically ill, those who are shut in, can't get to church, those whose health their health is failing. And this ministry to the sick should be a regular part of the ministry of the church. It should be something that clergy are responsible for, and church members expect that this is part of the pastoral care that they're going to receive, that they're going to receive. In the ministry to the sick, we are giving them the gift of Christ's presence and promises through prayer, scripture, and Holy Communion. When this is part of the regular ministry of the church, it puts the congregation in mind that health problems are not just physical problems, not just for the medical experts, but there are spiritual needs that have to be attended to. And if this sort of ministry has been ongoing, it paves the way for, it becomes kind of a natural extension when the person is in their final days. I had an example of this in the parish about 4 years ago, 5 years ago or so. There was an elderly man in his 90s whose health was failing, and he knew it, and he wasn't able to get out to church anymore. And so I was doing pastoral care with him, and Deacon Sarah was also doing pastoral care with him. But as he got sicker, he initiated this. He said, "Hey, can you come and see me?" I think it was like once every 2 weeks. Make sure that it's a regular thing of Holy Communion and prayer. And his daughter, who was not a Christian and not a tender of our church, she was always there. And so it was ministry to him, and she got to witness this ministry, and it was a witness to her. And so that when he went into hospice, when he went into his final days, it was just natural for her to pick up the phone and call us and say, "Here's what's going on with Dad. Come and be with him." And it just kind of was, again, a natural extension of something that had already been happening. But it just kind of intensified. We'll talk about this in the panel, how we can make sure nobody is falling through the cracks, or do our best here to make sure people aren't falling through the cracks who are sick and shut in. The rubrics say, and this is I want you to hear this as lay people, for those of you who are lay people, that some aspects of this healing ministry, most notably the absolution and formal blessings, those are reserved to bishops and priests, but other aspects of this ministry that's in the prayer book can be exercised by lay people. Okay. Second, in the prayer book, we have the rite entitled Ministry to the Dying. Ministry to the Dying. It's not exactly analogous to the last rites in the Roman Catholic Church. In the Roman Catholic Church, that's a sacrament, and it involves taking communion, confession, and anointing. But the rite of ministering the prayer book, it provides this, once again, this framework, this prayerful framework for seeing the dying person, in Julie Canlis's phrase, again, as a beloved pilgrim of God. Okay. And these rituals and these responses are so important, again, in framing this experience. In one of the articles that I read in preparation for this, a guy named Joshua Pauly wrote an article called Burial Plots in the Christian Tradition as a Subversive Witness Against Modern Funeral Practices. In this article, he quotes a philosopher a South Korean philosopher named Byung-Chul Han. And Han wrote a book called The Disappearance of Rituals in 2020. And in this book, Han says this. He highlights the power and centrality of ritual in human life. And he said this, through rituals, the valid order and values of a community are physically experienced and solidified. Through ritual, rituals create a bodily knowledge and memory within the context of a community. Ritual and community goes together. And there's a bodily dimension to being in community. See, it's kind of taps into what Thad was saying today about isolation. We don't want people who are suffering in this way to be isolated from community. And the ritual provides a underpinning for the sense that you belong to community. We're not going to forget about you. We're pilgrims together with you on this journey. But Han says this. He says, the disappearance of ritual transforms life into mere survival. And without them, we slip through. The sense of the sacred, the sense of a greater meaning here slips away, and we can slip through. And Joshua Pauly in this article says, mere survival and slipping through are apt descriptors of the way many people today experience illness, death, and grief. Rituals help us frame these experiences as Christians in the light of the gospel. And so that's why these are so important to practice as church communities. So in the rite entitled Ministry to the Dying in the Prayer Book, it provides a framework for understanding the dying person as a beloved pilgrim of God. And this is especially clear in the final prayers, the prayers of commendation at the time of death and the anointing and then the commending this person to the Lord in this beautiful prayer. Into your hands, O merciful Savior, we commend your servant. We humbly beseech you, a sheep of your own fold, a lamb of your own flock, a sinner of your own redeeming. This is not a patient dying, not just. This is a beloved child of God, a lamb of his flock. By the way, it says in the rubrics in this rite that this is intended to be prayed for with one who's received Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. That's the presupposition here. But this kind of ministry, the prayer book goes on to say, can be an occasion to ask people about their faith in Jesus Christ. And I found that I'm not naturally an evangelist, not given to that. That's not really a gift. I know it's something I'm called to do. But it's in the context of ministering to people who are sick and dying that there's an openness there to the gospel. And I'll often just ask the question, do you have peace with God as you're going through this? And just listen to what they say and how they're thinking about things spiritually. And just use that as an entryway into a conversation and point people who don't have the hope of the gospel to Jesus. By the way, again, speaking to those of you who are not members of the clergy, it says that in the absence of a member of the clergy, if you can't get hold of a pastor, a priest, a deacon, this service can be led by any Christian. Okay. The third prayer book resource that I want to point us to is, of course, the funeral liturgy itself, the burial of the dead. This is a traditional Christian funeral in contrast to a modern memorial service. And I want to kind of point out the differences. This comes from Thomas Long in his book on traditional or Christian funeral practices. But he says he identifies some features of the modern memorial service and contrasts this with the traditional Christian funeral service. So some features of the modern memorial service are... remembering the deceased is kind of central, who they are, what they accomplished, what they did, the kind of people they are or were. Remembering the deceased, but oftentimes without the body there. And sometimes, and I've done services like this, the person's been cremated, but the remains aren't even there. Maybe you've experienced this, becoming more common. The body is kind of embarrassing. He said, Thomas Long said, it's almost like a retirement party, but the guest of honor isn't present. The dead are not invited to their own service, he says. The funeral service, however, in the prayer book, it assumes the body is there. And we can talk about this maybe if we need to, about cremation and how this fits in. But Julie Canlis, in her notes on this, says, you know, if your loved one's going to be cremated, or if that's your plan, in terms of a traditional Christian funeral service, you want the remains to be there, to be present, if at all possible. Even better is to have the body there and then the cremation after. We are embodied creatures. We believe in the resurrection of the body, and having the body present and the prayers in relationship to this loved one who's died, and their body is still there, it gives more force to the hope of the resurrection of the body. Okay? He says, the funeral services, the modern memorial service is highly personalized and customized, involving usually several speakers, as opposed to the standard Christian funeral liturgy, which is presided over by the clergy. Now, this, of course, doesn't mean you can't have, and the funerals I do, I like to have people who know the person very well, family members, friends, speak. We want to talk about this person who's been made in the image of God and was a gift. So we want to bear witness to that, obviously, but we want the central focus to be on the hope of Christ and the resurrection. The Christian burial liturgy does not focus primarily on the achievements or failures of the deceased. Rather, it calls us to proclaim the good news of Jesus and his triumph over death, even as we celebrate the life and witness of the deceased and lament and give expression to our sorrow. And that's the next point. Oftentimes in these modern memorial services, the emphasis is on joy rather than sadness. And there's a sense that we don't really want to have a space for mourning and grief and facing the somber reality of death. Long traces some history of why this happened and, you know, the transition that happened. And then he says this. He defines the Christian funeral this way. I think this is helpful. So I'll read. This is a kind of lengthy definition, but I think this is helpful just as a way for us to think about what we're trying to do at a Christian funeral. It's an interesting definition, and maybe I'd be interested to see what your thoughts are on this definition. A Christian funeral is a piece of drama. There is a script. We all have parts to play in which the church reenacts the gospel by symbolically walking with the deceased on the pilgrim path toward resurrection, singing and praying as we go. The Christian funeral as a piece of drama. What do you think about that definition? Anybody want to maybe make a comment or a question or how that might help you think about it? If not, we can talk about it in the panel discussion.
Are you referring specifically to the funeral liturgy? Or just
the liturgy. The liturgy, yeah.
I think the very first sentence points us in the right direction. I am resurrection, I am life.
Yeah.
No one comes to me except through the Father. That's such a powerful statement. And then also in that whole first litany there is, you know, I myself shall see God.
Yes.
I mean, the whole thing centers on Jesus and this message of hope.
Yes.
And what we have. Yes. And that's the focus. And I think it's such a powerful beginning for him.
Very, yeah. Very much so. I personally experienced that as well. You know, you've been speaking about the prayer book, and there's definitely breadth for, you know, integrating your own personal prayers for the person, scriptures, but we have a tremendous blessing in that prayer book tradition. It's a common language we can use. I had a patient once, she was new to me, she probably should have been at hospice, but wasn't yet. I saw the prayer book, I pulled it out.
Mm.
To echo your point, I remember personally when my dad passed, and I looked down at the bulletin and it says, the Resurrection Liturgy of Robert William Mears Jr. There it is.
The Resurrection
Liturgy. There's no question, what's going on here? And
And you're positioning your body for the remains down the aisle.
That's exactly.
And right to the altar and right to,
That embodied action of the processional, you're traveling with them as fellow pilgrims, and then out afterwards, and then think about it in the old days when the churchyard was right next to the church. So you're all going together.
The other thing that comes to mind briefly is most of us don't arrive at, quote unquote, our anthropology in the abstract way pastors and theologians do. They don't sit down with a theology textbook and get it sorted. That's not bad. I'm of that sort.
Yeah.
But what's reinforced that is the stories in my own life, both fictional and actual.
Yeah.
Most people don't arrive at that anthropology we're saying is desirable.
Right.
Through abstract reflection.
Right.
They do it through the stories.
Right.
Their life is filled with good or bad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Restorying death. That's the drama piece.
That's
we're
right.
Telling a story.
That's right.
Just my take.
No.
Where are we going next?
We are storied creatures. We are narrative creatures. So we have to figure out what is the story of my life. How do I fit into this story? And this tradition situates us in that gospel story. No, that's good. So wrapping up here, my encouragement is for us clergy and laity to look to the prayer book to resource our ministry to the sick, the dying, and we didn't have time really, but maybe this can come up on the grieving, those who are processing the sorrow of losing a loved one, to provide language for us to make sense of these realities and to point us to the gospel. And so then my final suggestion, and I'll just make the suggestion here, is to think about doing what we did in our parish rectors, is to have a workshop dealing with this issue of finishing well, helping your people think about these things. In our case, we had a bioethicist talk to us about ethical decisions at the end of life. We had somebody, an estate planner, talk to us about estate planning. And that's actually, if you look in the prayer book, if you're a rector, look about what it says there. Like, this is one of your responsibilities to talk about to parishioners about investing in the ongoing work of the kingdom, What else did we do? We had, of course, Julie was there to talk about what happens at the end of life from a medical perspective. So I encourage you to do that. Draw on members of your congregation. And the last thing I want to say here is that this would, I hope, be the main, maybe a main takeaway from this talk, is that we just need to talk about this as a congregation. Alan Verhey says there's a conspiracy of silence over death and grief in our culture, and we need to break through that conspiracy, because we have the hope of the gospel in Jesus Christ, who died for us and is risen now.